Remember, Al Gore wanted to be president in 2000. So it was in the national consciousness. And if he had become president, I think that the world we live in today would be radically different. But he didn't. Instead, Bush and his fossil fuel buddies, they put us behind a good 25 years. And with climate change, that's the difference between permanent disasters and mitigating disasters.
Welcome to Let's Talk Change. Human history is a long series of adaptations to disruptive change. The impact of innovation and scalability of today's technologies is powerful. They either deteriorate or improve living conditions on Earth. In this podcast series, we sit down with decision makers, innovators, experts, and visionaries to discuss how technologies, business innovations, policies, and improved communication can drive the change we need to amplify sustainable behavior in business and politics for the benefit of the people and the planet.
Hello and welcome to the new edition of Let's Talk Change. My name is Doreen and I have a very special guest today. It is the head news anchor of Deutsche Welle, Brent Goff. Brent and I will talk about climate change and the media coverage and the difference in Europe and the US. We will talk about how the past administration in the US has changed generally the way media operates and how good or bad Trump has been for the press. We will also talk a bit about the election and what changes we'll see coming up in the next months and years. We will talk about what would have happened in terms of climate change if Al Gore would have been president 20 years ago, and about Elon Musk and the media coverage on his factory over here in Europe. This and much more on the next edition of Let's Talk Change. Hello and welcome to our podcast, Let's Talk Change. I've got one of my favorite news anchors here today. It's Brent Goff, and he has been at Deutsche Welle for 20 years. And he's the chief news anchor at Deutsche Welle. And we will talk about a lot of changes today, about the change due to the election in the US, about change in the media, and a lot more. So welcome, Brent, to the podcast Let's Talk Change. And yeah, what has changed in the last few days for you?
In the last few days, well, we had an election in the US, and it looks like we're going to have a new president, which is probably, you know, besides climate change, the pandemic, I think Biden is the biggest thing we've experienced. And it's the one of the positive things, I think, for most people that we've experienced. So maybe it's been one of the few things that 2020 has given us where we can breathe a sigh of relief. But, you know, it's one of those victories that will last, you know, this, you know, very short. And we know the problems are that long. So yeah, that's the biggest thing that's changed.
Before we look forward to the positive change, let's look a bit backwards in the Trump era. What do you think Trump is going to do? I mean, now he's fighting in court. He's not going to win it. We know that. What do you think Trump is going
to
do?
I know for a fact that he is worried about what will happen to him once he becomes a private citizen again. And, you know, there are lots of prosecutors who are ready to indict him for, you know, there's a litany of charges that could be lodged against him. And he knows that. So what would he do? One scenario is he would be like Edward Snowden and he would go to Russia, because Russia doesn't have an extradition agreement with the U.S. So he could go there and be protected from U.S. justice. That's possible. If Putin, you know, controls the money, which it appears he does, that's one. The other one is between now and January 20th, Donald Trump could create so much havoc that he forces Biden and the Democrats and the Republicans to make a deal with him. I'll give you a peaceful transfer of power and I'll walk away. You let me walk away with a pardon and everything's forgotten. That could happen. Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, and Donald Trump has been impeached, and he could be impeached again for stuff that he's done since the stuff with Ukraine. I think that Joe Biden may actually have Donald Trump's fate in his hands come January 20th. That's one possibility. The other would be they don't do anything and January 20th comes and he is charged and gets arrested. Maybe at some point goes to prison. I don't know if Biden wants to let that happen. A U.S. president ending up in prison. I don't know if that's something that you just haven't had that happen, right?
What change has Trump brought, especially if you look at it as a journalist? How did it affect your life as a journalist? How did it affect the media? And then we can talk about how it affected Americans and the world.
He has instilled a considerable amount of mistrust in public institutions, in the government, in the media. Everything that is part of the order that we have taken for granted has now been put into question by the most powerful man in the world. And that has made, as a journalist, I mean, he says we're the enemy of the people. You hear that all the time. And it's been a challenge. How do you report that? Normally, when a president talks, it's important and you report it. With Donald Trump, he tweets many times. It's not true what he says. What do? Do you report the lie that it was a lie? I mean, at some point, you worry that your viewers are going to become numb to what is happening.
Back to the problem also we've had, or you guys had, were you able as a reporter, or did you feel as a reporter, or as a news anchor, you were able to report objectively on Trump?
But, I mean, yeah, I feel like we reported as objectively as we would with any other head of state. You know, the U.S. president automatically gets a lot of attention just because of it's the world superpower. And he is the most powerful person. So he gets a lot of attention. What is different? I don't think it's the ability to try to be objective. I think it is we've been flooded with news stories about him to the point where it can seem like we fetishize Donald Trump. He's very good for the ratings. People may say they don't like him, but when he's on, people watch. So you've got this love-hate relationship with him, and it looks like everything Trump does, you have to report, and you're fetishizing it. I don't feel like we did that. I feel like in U.S. media, some did. I mean, there are some where it's obvious. Every time Donald Trump would, you know, go to the bathroom, there would be a live shot. But they're living also by ratings and advertising.
Taking a little deeper on that, because it's a very important subject, how much is the media, or do you see there's a difference between the U.S. and, let's say, Europe in the reporting, especially in the objective reporting?
Well, I mean, I think a good journalist is a good journalist no matter where you are. But the corporate system that you have to work in the U.S., you know, dictates that you have to make money. And so you treat news and information as a commodity, whereas in Europe, because of the tradition of public television, for example, news and information are treated more like a public good. I think it has an influence on the way information is presented, the way the news is presented. In America, it's flashier, but you have to get people's attention. Here, you know, we make a joke about the Tagesschau looks the same as it did in 1960, right? I mean, they've tweaked it a little, but it's still the same, and people like that. You never have anything like that in the U.S. But whether or not the reporting is better or the journalism, I mean, we have to remember, where are the great investigative stories and reporters? Most of them are in the U.S. They're the ones who dig, and they do that because of the environment that they're in. I would say the perfect system, there's not one, but if you could, would be to take that energy that you have in the U.S. and to mix it with the commitment here in Germany to treating news as a public good and not to commercialize it so much. But that's not going to change.
We don't live in an ideal world, but that also, having talked about the difference, which is clear, I mean, there are definitely corporate-driven news channels, and also the consumption is different. People watch more TV in the U.S. than they read the paper, right? Mm-hmm. But that brings me to a subject which, you know, is important to all of us. It's like climate change. So if a corporation drives a news channel, or even a newspaper, and has, let's say, dirt up its sleeve, you know, that's not being reported. Is that maybe one of the reasons why, you know, climate change has gotten as bad as it is, and maybe because we haven't heard so much before? Or do you feel like maybe the media hasn't been reporting in the, you know, early enough on it, or well, there wasn't enough information?
I'll give you an example. One of the first TV stories I did was on Earth Day in 1990, and Earth Day was big. I mean, that was my senior year of high school, and Earth Day was a big deal. And I remember us, we were 18 years old, thinking that by the year 2010, this momentum would have just grown and we would have green energy and pollution stopped. We really thought that it would only get better. And then I think the 90s came when history stopped. After the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union, the world, you know, like Fukuyama said, it was the end of history, right? And no one really pushed causes at that time. It was only after 9/11 that things changed that way. But I think if the news diet in the United States had been different, had been more like a European news diet, I think you would have had more attention to climate change. The scientists, they were telling us all the time this is happening, but how do you make that newsworthy? And it wasn't on the radar in the 90s. And that's a shame. Remember, Al Gore wanted to be president in 2000, right? So it was in the national consciousness. And if he had become president, I think that the world we live in today would be radically different. But he didn't. Instead, Bush and his fossil fuel buddies, they put us behind a good 25 years. And with climate change, that's the difference between permanent disasters and mitigating disasters.
On that subject, 25 years behind is obviously a major thing in the space of climate change. What do you expect now? I mean, Trump, in terms of climate change, he did nothing. So what do you expect now with a Biden administration? What changes can we look forward to?
Well, you know, he's already said immediately the first thing he's going to do, his first day in office, is going to sign executive orders, which will have the U.S. rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement. That's one. He's going to rescind all of the executive orders that Trump issued that deregulated environmental laws, for example, and the energy market in the U.S. All of that stuff will at first go back to the way it was at the end of the Obama era. And then, because I think Biden will make sure that the scientists have the say, I think you'll see a fast and radical attempt to make America the leader in the world in efforts to stop or mitigate climate change and to make green energy, renewable energies, profitable.
Do you think that will come from within the US, or do you think there will be like even big corporations and with Germany, because we have a lot of technology? Do you think generally the relationship between the US and Germany on an industrial level, as well as, you know, other administrative level, will get better?
Well, yeah, look at the coronavirus vaccine. That's an example right there. Pfizer and BioNTech, German-American partnership. And, you know, you can get a lot of know-how from Germany, but what the Germans don't have is economies of scale. America has that, but just by virtue of its size and being one country, you can take technology, you know how here, take it and Americanize it and apply it, and then you get that momentum that you need for an industry to go global. And I think that that could happen.
And another question on that, and maybe you being an American living in Berlin for such a long time can explain this to me. The Fridays movements in, well, Europe, especially also Germany, were quite big or still big, you know. It's never gotten really to the U.S., has it? Why is that?
I think because the U.S. has been very, very busy with itself. That's why. It's not that it's not reported, but the U.S. is in turmoil right now, and it's a polarized place. It's probably the worst time to have to save the environment, but that's what has happened. And, you know, we shouldn't sugarcoat things. You know, here in Europe, it took a schoolgirl from Sweden to finally get the ball rolling. It's not like France or Germany gave the world that. So it's not something, and also, I mean, let's be honest, it's not something that really captivates people's imagination. People want the weather to stay nice. They want the climate to be steady, but it's not a sexy story, right? I mean, you see hurricanes and that stuff. Okay, those are stories that people watch, but it doesn't have staying power. That's the problem. I mean, Al Gore had that problem, you know? Like, how do you make this story stick? Remember when he did the film An Inconvenient Truth?
You know, which I think he's still running around the world.
He's got his part two to it now.
Yeah.
And you know, that was when he put Hollywood and climate change together.
Yeah, there's Leonardo DiCaprio with his foundation doing a lot, but it doesn't feel, at least, but I don't live in the U.S. anymore, so I can't say, but it doesn't feel like it's a major movement or it gets major attention over there.
Well, no, it does. It does. It's just, I think that people think about it as much as they do here, but I think here you have, especially in Germany, there's a longer history of trying to green everything, right? You have the Green Party here that goes all the way back to the late 70s. You know, that's very different from what you had in the States. So I think people do think about it. It's just here, it's maybe it's a part of your DNA more because it's been part of society longer.
But that I would like to challenge, because in the US you have way more natural catastrophes like fires in California, you know, hurricanes on the East Coast and stuff. So people are way more affected by it actually than there are here, because Germany is quite safe. It may have some flooding, maybe some drought sometime, but it's not a major impact. So when it comes to the US, you're way more affected. So I would assume, you know, that people would go more in the streets than they would here, because it affects their livelihood, their economy and everything. And it makes a story. I mean, fires make a story, hurricanes make a story, but it's just never associated
but
to climate change.
What happens after those disasters? What happens? You have FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, goes in. If an area is declared a disaster area, it gets federal funding, and then houses are rebuilt. People go back and they try to start again. You don't have relocation programs. Look at Florida. You know, the city of Miami now has sub pumps in the sewer system of the city that are pumping water now 24/7. If they didn't have that, downtown Miami would have water in the streets. Now, if I lived there, I would be alarmed by that. But they consider it to be just part of the way it is when you live near the water. But it's not. You know, people lived there for centuries and that didn't happen. I think people are in denial about it. I mean, what is going to happen has just, that doesn't sit in. And the government is responsible for giving them programs that allow them to deny and repress what's happening. They can build back. They can get insurance. Think about that. They can get flood insurance still. Now, what would happen if the insurance companies stopped giving insurance? Then you've got all these people suddenly uninsured. Then you've got an economic crisis that you're creating. So see, all of these things are tied together, and no politician has tried to untie them yet.
It's a question of policy, no question asked. I mean, the only reason why Germany had sort of a green industry building up is because of frameworks, policies, etc.
And you paid for it too. I mean, there was a long time where green renewables were expensive. The subsidies were huge. Think about just solar panels, for example, here, developed here before the Chinese got it. And I mean, tons of public money went into that.
Well, I mean, fossils were subsidized too. We won't go into the subsidy discussion. I think that's completely. But the U.S. could do it easily as well. I mean, they put a lot of money elsewhere. But my question is not about the subsidies and how to basically get an industry sort of off the hook. My question is more like, isn't it also about information and education at the end of the day, you know, and where are the levels here and what needs to be done, in your opinion, or change in order to get the people aware of what's happening so that they fight for it, that they ask for it?
Here you're not impacted by the climate change as much as you would be in North America, for example. So you hear, maybe you don't feel it. And I think in North America, by the year 2040, 2050, I think you will see a radical change in what people perceive and what they demand as well, because there will be mass migration and relocations, people moving away from the coastal areas, and then you're going to have the areas inland that are suddenly are going to fill up. Property values are going to go up, price. I mean, all of this disruption is going to happen, and then you can't ignore it. It's just a matter of time. Mother Nature is going to take care of that. I tell you this, I remember when Jimmy Carter was president. You know, he was only a one-term president as well, but I remember as a kid on the interstate highways, he was responsible for the signs having miles and then kilometers for distances. And that was when the U.S. was going to go to the metric system. He was on track to do things that would have probably put America and Europe more in alignment. And then Ronald Reagan came and got rid of all of that. I remember seeing the signs on the roads with kilometers. The signs got old in the mid-80s, and then they were eventually replaced with new signs. No more kilometers. America has had several periods where they could have really gone forward, and they didn't.
How do you see America right now in comparison to Europe? There's still a lot of technology coming. Just talking about Elon Musk, there is Bezos changing, you know, the way we shop and all of that. Where do you see the strengths in Europe, you know, from what you report on and what you see and the people you talk to, and the strengths also in America? Where could we come together? Where, you know, where would be the corporations?
A couple of things. You know, venture capital is hard to get here compared to the U.S. So that your seed money is the problem here, which means if you are a Bill Gates or some young person, it's hard for you to get money, somebody to take a risk, right? The U.S. is different. The other thing is...
Well, actually, Bill Gates just announced, just to drop that in, yeah. The new hydrogen initiative here in Europe. It's called, I think, the Green Hydrogen Accelerator, mm-hmm. together with EIT and our energy. So he is obviously interested in Europe coming
he
here.
He sees it. Yes, he sees it. I think the U.S. will still keep its lead because of what's happening with China, this Cold War that is developing between the U.S. You know what happened in the Cold War with the Soviets? U.S. technology, exploded because the military was also involved. And I think we're going to see the same thing happen with China. The difference is China is a technological equal. Artificial intelligence, they're ahead of everybody. So the United States will have to really dot its I's and cross its T's with research. But I think that will drive the innovation too. And I think if Europe and the U.S. stay together, I mean, it sounds very 20th century.
Get back together again.
Well, I mean, it sounds very, lots of people, like interns at work think that I sound like a dinosaur when I talk about it. But the only way you can counteract China is for Europe and North America to be a bloc. And I always say, to my interns, well, let's imagine we didn't have the Western world as our guide. Who's going to replace us? The Russians or the Chinese? Great. You get social scores based on your behavior every day, which is checked by, facial recognition, cameras all over the place. That's the world you want to live in. And then they don't realize what it is, what the alternative is. And I'm hoping that maybe we will be able to instill that in them so that they don't screw up everything as badly as we have.
People like Elon Musk and Tesla, they came over here and they're now investing into big factory, gigafactory here. There are all sorts of other collaborations, especially when it comes to the automobile sector. Do you think we will see more of that? Or do you feel like also in your reporting, did it have some effect on generally the reporting where there were some negative reports, especially in the German media
About Elon Musk?
Yeah,
building up Tesla. The reporting on Elon Musk, I found it to be really poor, and there's not much. I mean, this gigafactory, I've looked at what has been reported, and a lot of it I think is very provincial. It's like local news talking about the trees that have to be cut down, or little communities or the villages that are protesting the traffic that will increase, things that you don't expect from a Weltstadt, right? So you've had a lot of that, but in terms of the incentives that the German government and the Berlin government, and the Brandenburg government gave Elon Musk to come here, there's not much reporting about that either. And I think, that's part of the story. But also asking him, what is it about Germany that made you want to come here? It's expensive to produce stuff here. And yet he's still coming here. Why? I mean, it's because the workforce here is educated and highly skilled. One, and he got a great deal with the government here.
Which he would never get in the U.S.
Well, no, he could. They almost always do. But he knows, with electric cars, for example, you can see out on the streets here where all the stations to charge up. I mean, it's going to happen here before it happens in the U.S.
Do you really think so?
I think so. But I think, again, we go back to economies of scale. The United States will have to do it so that it takes off. Germany's not big enough. Germany's smart enough, but it's not big enough to get that going. And once the Americans finally
get it going, they get it going fast.
Right. That's right. Look at California. They're going to ban gasoline cars by 2035. That's huge. That's huge. California is like the fifth largest economy in the world. When they say no more cars with gasoline, just electricity, that will permanently change the entire industry. It will automatically.
You've mentioned something on the reporting that the media here didn't report as well, let's say, on Elon Musk coming here with this gigafactory. Why do you think that is? And what needs to be changed here? Because generally it is fairly objective, I would say.
The excitement is missing. It's a great story. It's a great economic story for this area. But I mean, this is a funky, futuristic project, and it's coming to Berlin. And Elon Musk, his personality is also, he wants to go and live on Mars or something. I mean, he is a schräger Vogel, right? I mean, he's a character. And if you put all that together, that's a great story. And I think that that's missing here a little bit. Maybe they think it's sensationalizing it or trivializing it, but it's not. This man has millions and millions and millions of dollars that he's bringing over here. It would be worth our time to do a couple of features on what makes makes him tick.
Maybe it's because he doesn't have a press department anymore. What do you think about that?
That could be. I will say this. When they made the announcement about putting the factory here, they did like a Zoom press conference. And Elon Musk was surprised or maybe puzzled when he found out that the factory is not actually in Berlin. It's in Brandenburg. Now, I mean, that's a minor detail, but it's important. There's a difference. And he wasn't aware of that. And that's not, you know, being attentive to details that you would expect a man like that to be.
But when it comes to reporting coverage, I'm not just talking about TV, but generally, and you're a reporter. Reporting, and we've discussed this in Germany or in Europe, is different than it is in the US. If, as a European company, I go across and I'm looking into communication, what is it I have to look at? I mean, especially if you look at Elon Musk, how he's presenting himself and stuff. What do people or companies have to look out for?
In the States, everybody, you know, goes through media training, right? And they know how to put a message in a soundbite. They know that you have to craft one message and you have to stay with that message and you have to hammer that message repeatedly, repeatedly, repeatedly. And that's how you get through.
I mean, you get news every day from companies, that whether it's press releases, whether it's companies, whatever it is. Do you see a difference between, like, let's say, an American company and a European or German company?
Well, yeah, I mean, German companies still rely on press releases. In the U.S., it's all social media now. And that's a big difference. I mean, you know, we joke at work that in Germany, people still use fax machines. And I don't think I've seen a fax machine in the U.S. since 1995. I just haven't. So, you know, that's the Germans hold on to things longer. If I get a press release, you look at it and you're like, what is this? It looks so official, like it's from the government or from a bureaucracy, and you don't think it's really news. And so messages get lost that way.
Well, I mean, I know for a fact that the German media still likes its press releases.
They
have been studies on that, so that's not an issue. But generally saying, we work globally, so we notice the difference in different regions. But there is much more on social media, right, in the U.S., as well as in Asia, as well as in Africa. Yeah. So there's barely anything via mail or anything anymore.
That's
so you do communicate via the social channels. And this is why it's very important to have a good social media presence. That's where you get basically the news from, or when you search for interview partners your producers do. Where do they go? They go on the socials.
And they look. And that's where you can establish immediate credibility. It's your presence on social media. You know, people will say, oh, okay, yeah, he's legitimate. She's not. That's the litmus test.
And what makes you legitimate on social? Because you, in this case, are a user of that. In this case, you consume the news. What makes you kind of interested in a person, company, fact, whatever is on there? How do you use it? Like, how do you use it for your work?
I mean, for work, you would look at, you know, their Twitter feed and what they have posted and reposted, because that reflects what is important to them. You see their value system in that. And you see who maybe they're linked with as well. You know, I mean, you can really cross-check things. You look at the number of followers. I mean, we don't do that as much as we used to, because you can't verify the numbers anymore. So what is it if somebody has 80,000, are they really 80,000 people, or how many bots are there? You know, you just don't know. It's the content that is the size.
Brent, thank you very much. It was a very interesting and insightful discussion. Anytime again. And yeah, thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, Doreen.
Thanks again for tuning in. We hope you'll join us next time on Let's Talk Change. We are proud to be powered by DWR Eco, an international clean tech consultancy for business strategies, communications, and public affairs.